So welcome again to our wonderful JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning series. Today, a very special class, The Hope of Rabbi Akiva. So we're going to have a journey together today on my personal hero. I think he, other than maybe Moshe, Moses, and the patriarchs, if I had an opportunity to meet a singular individual in Jewish history, no question I would have the greatest honor. I'd be a little scared, a little daunting, because he was a brilliant, brilliant rabbi. So be a little daunting. I probably would be cut out in my learning capabilities. But I would still have, just have the honor of hearing a class, a Torah class from Rabbi Akiva. I probably wouldn't understand it, because that's on sort of a quantum physics level. But it would be a joy to be there and to have the honor of the greatest Talmudic scholar in history, without question. Okay. So let's now take a little journey on the life of Rabbi Akiva. So before we go into our source sheet, let's talk about Rabbi Akiva. And I'm going to parallel for you right now the life of Rabbi Akiva with the life of the greatest Jew who ever lived, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our prophet. And you'll see that they parallel each other in very powerful ways. For example, the most striking similarity is that both Moses and Rabbi Akiva lived 120 years. Amazing. You also could section their lives 40, 40, and 40. So for example, Moses really doesn't do anything significant. The first years of his life, he's in the palace. But then the last 40 years of his life, you essentially meet him at age 80 as he comes from Midian, where he was being protected from Pharaoh's revenge because he had betrayed Pharaoh by killing the Egyptian taskmaster. So he seeks a sanctuary in Midian. And then the last 40 years of his life, essentially, he's with the Jewish people shepherding us through the sea, to Mount Sinai, and ultimately on the precipice of the Promised Land, where he dies at age 120. And Rabbi Akiva also parallels this in a very powerful way. The first 40 years of his life were kind of similar to Moshe, to Moses. He wasn't going to Hebrew school. In fact, he was a shepherd. And he was, to quote my good pal, the great Rabbi Bugs Bunny, he was an ignoramus. A real Amaretz, supposedly. And there are those who say maybe he had a little learning, but he didn't have much going on there. And he was a shepherd. And then the second 40 years of Rabbi Akiva's life, he became Rabbi Akiva. And he cultivated and impacted 24,000 young men who eventually became incredible rabbis of their own. And then they were taken from him. And then the last 40 years of his life, went to the south of Israel and had 5 new students in his twilight years. And it was through the glory and majesty of that relationship, through those 5 students, that he rebuilt Torah in our world. And the Torah that we have now, the Talmud, is all according to the words of Rabbi Akiva as taught by his students. Right there in a famous Talmudic tractate called Sanhedrin. So it's a very powerful idea. 40, 40, and 40. Very interesting. So let's talk about Rabbi Akiva. And the reason we call it the hope of Rabbi Akiva, Hatikva, is the hope. And it's also the national anthem, as you know, of Israel. We celebrated Yom Ha'atzmaut, the most difficult Yom Ha'atzmaut, Israel birthday, Israel Independence Day, this past Tuesday. This past Monday, we commemorated the fallen, the 24,000 Israeli soldiers, men and women, who've given up their lives since 1947-48. And we've been included in that number of victims of terror. And it was a very, very powerful Yom HaZikaron, Day of Remembrance, of memory, this past Sunday night, Monday in Israel. In fact, they have a siren in Israel. You may have heard about this. And when the siren sounds, all of Israel stops for a moment, no matter what they're doing. So hopefully the people on the highways get the message, because they literally pull off the highway and stand at attention for a minute. I assume they're doing this in advance and not braking from 120 miles an hour. But in Israel, they have that moment of silence. And it's a very powerful, profound moment this year, more than any other year, because of the war in Gaza and the war that is really going on at every border. You may not be aware of this, but Israel's fighting almost a war with Hezbollah in the north. You have Syria involved a little bit, so that's sort of to the northeast. Then you have the west border, where you have the Jordan area, the river across, we call it the Yarden, the Jordan River, and you have what's called the West Bank area, and there's terrorism almost every day, or people are trying to commit acts of terror from the Palestinian Authority-controlled areas that are supposed to be protected by that treaty that they did years and years ago, but it's not really working very well. And then, of course, in the south, you have Gaza, Hamas. So Israel sort of is fighting a multi-front war. You even have these, again, this is way, way out to the east of Israel, but you may have heard of a little place called Yemen. And for some reason, the world has not paid attention to Yemen, and you have these terrorists in Yemen. They're called Houthis. And they've shut down the world's supply of transport through the Red Sea area, through the different ships and things, because they're terrorists and they're shooting missiles at Israel, at Eilat, in the southern port of Israel, and the world's not really paying. So Israel's fighting a multi-front war, and there's a lot of concern, as you can imagine, in Israel. So my point today with Rabbi Akiva is that his life was very, very challenging. So let's talk about Rabbi Akiva. So as a young man, he didn't get the benefit of learning Torah. Didn't go to cheder, didn't go to Hebrew school, never learned with Giver Pernikov how to even read Hebrew. And he was a shepherd for the wealthiest man in all of Israel. His name was Kalba Savua. I'm quoting you now from the Talmud. So we are told that Kalba Savua had a beautiful daughter. Her name was Rachel. And she would talk with this shepherd, Akiva, who worked for her dad. Now, back then, shepherds were very low on the pecking order of decent jobs. And you see this even in the Torah itself. Like, for example, when Jacob comes to the well, where he's going to meet Rachel, another Rachel by the well, these guys are pretty disreputable people. Like, they are, criminal element, shall we say. So he was not, God forbid, of the criminal element. But again, in the eyes of a Kalba Savua, who is this, Zuckerberg, Elon Musk-style Jewish man living in Israel with all the power and majesty, the idea that his daughter would even be talking to one of his shepherds was not very pleasing. And when they developed a little bit of a romance, meaning she saw within the confines of Rabbi Akiva's mind the brilliance that he would possess later, and she uniquely saw this, no one else, even Rabbi Akiva at the time, Akiva did not see this perhaps within himself. And the story goes, it's an amazing story, it's again brought down in the Talmud, that he was walking by a flowing river, and he saw the water overflowing rocks. And you have erosion, I believe is the term, as the water slowly erodes the rock over many, many centuries. And he felt that this was a sign that his heart was hard like a rock. It was impenetrable. It wasn't open to God and to all the things that he could use his potentiality for. And water is a metaphor for Torah. We call Torah Mayim Chayim, the water of life. And he saw the water would wash over this hardened heart, which was his heart, that was inured to God. And that philosophically changed his life, opened him up to the potential to learn Torah. And Rachel said to him, let's get married. Now this was a very big issue for Rachel, because her father would lose his mind if Rachel came to him and said, hey, I fall in love with the shepherd Akiva, and we're going to get married with your sanction, of course, dear dad, let's make a big chuppah, right? We'll have a big shmorg and a great, great chatunah, a great wedding. So on one condition, Rachel says to Akiva, will I marry you? He says, what's that? That you need to go learn in yeshiva. You need to fulfill the God-given potential that you have, that I see within you, that maybe you're not even aware of, but I know who you could become. You could become a giant. So on the condition that you will leave me to support you while you go away and learn, because it costs money for the tuition costs, right? That's the only reason I'll marry you. And he said, sure, we're in. So they got married. But Kalba Savua, the father, was decidedly unhappy. He threatened her. He said, Rachel, you can't do this. I'm doing this. Rachel, if you do this, I can't have you in my life. And he gave her an ultimatum. You don't want to give someone an ultimatum, especially somebody you love. And he took a solemn oath, very serious thing in Torah terms. It's called a Shavua. In fact, it's so serious, before we go into Yom HaKippurim, we have that service, right? The most famous service, you're all familiar with it, called Kol Nidre, where we try to sort of at least annul the vows and promises we make. But this was a solemn oath. And he said, Rachel, my dear daughter, I love you, but I cannot sanction your relationship with my shepherd, Akiva. And it's not allowed. And I swear, and he invoked God's name in the Torah, that if you proceed with this, I cannot support you. I cannot materially support you. You cannot benefit one shekel from me. And he thought, there's no way she's going to transgress his wishes. She did. She lived in abject poverty. She got jobs as a maid. And she would take the monies that she made and send it away to her husband's yeshiva, where he was away learning. And it went on for 7 years. Poor Rachel. Now, Kalva Savua, dad, had second and third regrets. He felt badly. And he saw the shame and humility, embarrassment that his daughter Rachel was going through, and he was powerless to help her. So at the end of 7 years, which was the condition of the marriage, at 7 years you dedicate yourself to learning Torah. And when Rabbi Akiva went to learn Torah for the first day, they said, we don't really have a place for you. You know, you have potential, you're a smart guy, but you don't know the Aleph base. You don't know Aleph and Bet and Gimel and Dalet. So the only place you could go would maybe be the kindergarten class, ostensibly. And he said, that's okay, I'm in. I think he progressed through the school pretty fast. And by 7 years, he already became a legend. He was already giving classes and not being part of the classes. Brilliant mind. And so he came back to surprise Rachel at the end of 7 years, which was their understanding. As he's coming to town, this bitter, cynical old man is berating his wife, Rachel. He says, you're good for nothing, husband. Where is he? You're like a widow because he's not around. You're absentee husband. Good for nothing guy. She says, not good for nothing. He's doing exactly what he and I promised each other that he would do. And that was the nature of our relationship and our marriage. So if he could only hear me now, I would only wish that he would spend 7 more years learning. So Rabbi Akiva turned around and went back for 7 more years. Okay, so 14 years have passed. It's a great story, right? It's going to be on Netflix very soon. 14 years pass. 14 years. And Rabbi Akiva is now the possessor of 24,000 Talmidim. He has 24,000 students all over the world, but mainly Israel, who have had the opportunity to learn Torah from him and consider him their Rebbe, their teacher, their mentor. So he's extraordinary, the greatest in the history of our world in Talmudic lexicon. No one came close. So he comes back to town with an entourage, and he's so delighted to meet his beloved Rachel. So Rachel comes out to meet her husband, but nobody really connects the two of them together. And so she puts on her finery. Believe me when I tell you that her finery ain't fine. And so when the students, who are sort of like a little bit protective of Rabbi Akiva's honor, when they see this woman coming out sort of to try to talk to him, they don't know that who Rachel is. They sort of stand in between their Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, their teacher, and this woman. Unbeknownst to them, this is his wife. And when Rabbi Akiva sees this, he is mortified. Horrified. He says to them, stop, what are you doing? What are you doing? Let her come close. Don't you understand that my Torah, your Torah, all belong to this woman? They're her Torah. She's the owner of everything you know and everything that I've accomplished. It's hers. Let's give her the honor that she deserves. So when dear old dad, Kalva Savua, hears that this legendary rabbi, he has no idea of any relationship that he has to him, son-in-law, he doesn't know, but he hears that this legendary rabbi has come to town. And he thinks to himself, you know, maybe because he is the greatest and brightest mind in the world, he will find a loophole, a legal loophole, to annul my vow, that dumb vow that I took 14 years ago, depriving me of my beloved Rachel. So I'm going to seek his audience. Now, he is Kalvasavu. He's the biggest guy. So he seeks the audience of this rabbi. And he says to the rabbi, please, rabbi, 14 years ago, I did something stupid beyond words. And he describes what he did. He took a solemn oath. And I have been to many other rabbis, and they are helpless to help me. They can't annul my vow. There are no grounds to nullify my vow. And I miss my daughter. I want to help her. What do I do? So the rabbi says to Kalba, tell me something, sir. Your son-in-law that you had a grievance with the marriage, yeah? What if he was a Torah scholar? Would you have given license to Rachel to marry such a person, even if he wasn't wealthy? So Kalba says, a Torah scholar? What? He says, if this shepherd had even known one verse of the Torah, one verse, one word, and could explain it, I would have been overjoyed. I would have been over the moon to give permission. Well, in that case, the rabbi says, if that's true, then that vow that you made was a mekatal, so it was made in error. It wasn't with full information of what was happening. And therefore, those are grounds to retroactively nullify that oath. I give you permission to be back in part of Rachel. Oh, by the way, I'm your son-in-law. They call me Rabbi Akiva. So after Kalba Savua picked himself up off the floor, you know he must have passed out from shock, right? So after he picked himself up on the floor and dusted off the dirt, he gave half of his very vast estate to support Rachel and Rabbi Akiva for the rest of their lives. So, great story, right? Doesn't this sound like a phenomenal story? Okay. But, unfortunately, there's a sequel to the story that's not going to be as romantic or beautiful. Because the 24,000 students who were the shining light of Torah in our world were all taken from us during this period of time, right now, from Passover to Shavuot, where we commemorate the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And that is source number one of two sources in your source sheet right now. Are you ready? Now, the source is actually credited to Rabbi Akiva. He said a drasha, a exegesis on a verse from a book which was horrifically named, but it's kind of a powerful book. It's called Ecclesiastes. I don't know why someone decided to give this book the name Ecclesiastes, right? They'll say it's ecclesiastical. Well, good luck in if you play like Scrabble or Bananagram. Did you ever make Ecclesiastes in Bananagram? That's a good one, right? If I knew how to spell it, maybe we could make it, but I don't think I could spell it. Good word, though. It's ecclesiastical. I don't know how many points in Scrabble you would, that'd be more than seven letters, so you couldn't make that word. You'd have to sort of make it from something else. Tickle. Right? That would be a good one. All right. Any Scrabble players and Bananagrams are smiling. So, here is the autobiography of Rabbi Akiva. He spoke about himself, and he's quoting a verse in Ecclesiastes. The book is actually called Koheles. And Koheles is magically written by Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of men. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. So listen to this. Rabbi Akiva said, even if one has learned Torah in his youth, he should learn Torah. All right, fine. He didn't say yut. I'm just paraphrasing. Even if one has learned Torah in his youth, he should learn Torah in his old age. Even if one had disciples, students in his youth, he should have disciples in his own age. How do we know this? As it says, and this is in Ecclesiastes, in the morning, baboker, zeroes arefo. You should sow your seed, plant your seeds in your life, in the morning of your life, the early years, your youth. And in the evening, in the erev, al tenach yedecha. Do not idle, don't rest your hands. Don't rest on your laurels. Don't go to Miami Beach and kick up your feet, because that's not what you should be doing. For you cannot know which will succeed. This, what you did in the early part of your life, or that, what you did in the latter years of your life, or whether both are equally good. Stop for one moment. So this is eerily autobiographical, because this is, as we spoke about earlier, the life and times of Rabbi Akiva. In his youth, that middle 40-year section we spoke about, he cultivated and nurtured and grew the 24,000. So that was his Boker. That was sort of his youth, if you will. But then in his old age, as we will see, he did not rest. He did not give up with the shattering loss of those 24,000. No. He rose up and created something special, even in his Erev, in the evening of his life. The twilight years, you would say. Okay, so let's carry on. This is the only source in all of 2,700 double-sided folios, pages of Talmud, where we know anything about what happened to Rabbi Akiva's students. There's not a lot of information there, but let's go through it. They said, meaning the rabbis, Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of disciples, 24,000 for those who are mathematically challenged, from Givat, which is in the south of Israel, until Antiparis, which is sort of northeast. And they all died during one period because they did not treat each other with respect. The world was left barren until Rabbi Akiva came to our rabbis in the south of Israel and taught the Torah to them. Who were these rabbis? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. It was these later disciples who upheld the study of Torah at that time. A Tana stated, a rabbi, all of the 12,000 pairs of disciples died between Pesach, Passover, and Shavuot. And I mentioned this only in the Hebrew part, the name of the plague that they died from is called Azkara. Azkara. Some people connect it to diphtheria. There's other theories about what it is. We'll speak about that in a moment. So this is not a lot of information. What do we know? That Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. 12,000 pairs of students. So other classes I've had, I've mined the idea of what that could mean in terms of learning. But we're not going to go there today. That's a different class. Another year. Suffice it to say that these 24,000 died during this period of time. And because of their loss, and the incalculable loss to our world, because think about it for a moment. If we didn't have the lovely Roman Empire persecuting, crucifying Jews all over the world, and if those 24,000 had been allowed to live, how many students would each of the 24,000 have taught? And the students would have taught other students and taught others. Can you imagine where we would be today? What a loss. One human being that survives the Holocaust, Tova, has children and grandchildren. And when you see pictures of weddings of survivors, one couple who survived the Holocaust could have a legacy already of a couple hundred people. So you can imagine 24,000 and just take from there the numbers. It's enormous. So today, literally right now, many Jews in the world have mourning practices, that we don't go to live concerts and beard cutting or hair cutting or shaving, listen to live music and stuff. So they do this out of deference to Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students. So we realize that there is a void in our world which we don't even connect to because it's so enormous, it's mind-boggling to even think about what our world could have been with the 24,000. Now, why did they die? So it's not clear at all what it means they didn't show honor to one another. But again, that was the other class that we gave. We're not going to go there. But what I believe is, very simply, the Talmud is writing here in a code. It's a little bit of a code. Because you have to know the history of Rabbi Akiva to understand perhaps what happened to these 24,000 students. So you may have heard of a man who Rabbi Akiva believed was the Mashiach. And maybe he really was, but he just wasn't the right time for the Messiah. And his name was Bar Kosiba. People called him Bar Kochba. Very, very interesting historical figure. They have coins with his image on it. And he, Bar Kochba, led a failed rebellion against the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire crushed the would-be rebels without mercy in horrific ways. But even before that Bar Kokhba rebellion, which happened in the year 130 of the Common Era, even prior to that, there were other horrific massacres of Jews at the hands of the Roman Empire. So it could very well be that the loss of these 24,000 students was because Rabbi Akiva was identifiably the single most dangerous man to the Romans because of his learning, because of his brilliance and his inspiration that he gave to so many. The fact that he was cultivating the masses in learning, and when they learned, they realized, we don't want the Romans oppressing us and destroying our temple. The temple was destroyed in the year 70, and we're now 60 years post that when you get to the Bar Kokhba rebellion. So the Jewish world was not happy. They were not accepting. Rabbi Akiva was their figurehead. And they actually outlawed him teaching Torah in public, which we'll speak about in a moment. So what happened to the 24,000? So nobody really knows. Nobody really knows. You don't get a death penalty at the hands of God, no matter how righteous you are, for not showing proper respect to somebody else. So whatever that means, it doesn't mean what it says. It's very superficial. It's clearly not what it means. So one possibility is that they were killed as a direct result of either the Bar Kokhba failed rebellion or in prior rebellions. And that word azkara, which is the Hebrew word for like diphtheria, this disease that affected them, it's a lack of oxygen. I did not know this, but you can research this. Apparently, when one is crucified and their body starts to collapse upon itself, you actually die of oxygen deprivation. I didn't know this. I'm not a doctor, but there are doctors who walk among us who can tell us this. Like, I mean, it's a horrific thing. But either way, I believe that we use the word disease as a metaphor, a euphemism for the Roman Empire. They are the disease. Mm. They died at the hands of the Romans. So we lost the 24,000. So poor Rabbi Akiva, it is the apple of his eye. He's created this amazing world with these students, and they're all just taken away in a one period of time, in this horrible chapter of his life. They're all blown up. They're all dead. How did he respond? He responded in an amazing way. He didn't give up. He always held within him a hope, that tikva, that hope for the future no matter what. And instead of, I would have given up. I think I just would have cried myself to death at that point. What would be the point? You know, my life's inspiration. It's not just that, but the 24,000 students, he loved them. They were like his children. They're all gone. He didn't give up. And it says, as we say, that the world was barren and desolate. But Rabbi Akiva did not allow it to remain barren and desolate. No. Because that wasn't Rabbi Akiva. He went to the southern part of Israel. And there were these five great would-be Torah scholars. Among them, two of the shining lights in the history of the Talmud. The great Rabbi Meir, who was so brilliant, his name means light. Because he would shine light in people's eyes. He could argue any side of an argument and win both. That made him a nightmare, by the way, when it comes to Jewish law. Because you could say, Rabbi Meir, this is my side of the story. What do you think? And he would say, here are the proofs. You're absolutely right, Rabbi Kaplan. And the other guy would say, wait a minute, you haven't heard my side, Rabbi. And he would give his side. And Rabbi Meir would bring proofs. He's also right. Yeah! What do we do? So the rabbis have very real issues here because you don't know. The light is so bright that illuminated from Rabbi Meir that you're not really sure which side to go because he could argue the Sanhedrin or Kategor. He could be the defense attorney or the prosecutor and win both. Wow, good gig, you know, good gig. So Rabbi Meir was one of the illustrious five. And even more famous than Rabbi Meir was the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who very famously is author of the Kabbalah, this Zohar book of mysticism, the brightness, as he hid from the Romans in a cave and taught himself Torah with the sun. And again, that's another fantastic story in the Talmud. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, every year, there's a city where he's buried in northern Israel. They had a horrible tragedy there a couple of years ago where a bunch of people who were pilgrims to come to the site on Lag BaOmer, in just a week and a half, they were crushed to death because you may remember there was some police did not unlock this gate and the crowd surged tragically people were killed. Yes. That was on the day of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's death. which he said, my death should not be memorialized, it should be celebrated. And so people from all over Israel would go to this place called Meron, this little sleepy village where he and his son are buried side by side. I visited them. And also Hillel and Shammai are buried very close by, the two great sages. And so that is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, again, one of the five students of the magical Rabbi Akiva. So now we have fleshed out the life of Rabbi Akiva. So let me share with you one of the most amazing pieces of Talmud in all of Talmud. Okay? And I'm going to just share it with you outside. But it's all here. You'll read it after, take it home, and enjoy. Here is what the Talmud says. This is in Makos. This is in a Talmudic tractate called Makot. So here's the story. Takes place, we don't exactly know the year, but it's after, clearly, the destruction of Temple number 2 in the year 70. So it's somewhere between 70, 80, 90 of the Common Era. Four great rabbis. Rabban Gamliel, who was the head of the highest Jewish court in the land, the Sanhedrin. Rabban Gamliel was one of them. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who's also mentioned, by the way, in your Haggadah, who became the de facto head of that court for a short time, and then they power shared later on. I won't go into the story, but there's a whole story there. Kind of fun. So Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and maybe the greatest sage in the world other than Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehoshua, were with Rabbi Akiva, the four of them. Again, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Joshua in English, and Rabbi Akiva, the four of them were coming into the area of Jerusalem and where the Kotel HaMa'aravi, where the Western Wall stands today. And they were coming down from Har HaTzofim. In English, it's called Mount Scopus. There's a big hospital up on Mount Scopus in Israel, Hadassah, yeah. Right. So it's a magnificent hospital. So it's up on Mount Scopus. So when you're in Har HaTzofim coming down, you can actually see where the temple stood. And it's not clear exactly how many years after the temple's destruction, but it's enough that the embers are no longer burning, and this place have been rendered asunder. It's basically like a forest, trees and greenery. That's what's left inside the area that was the second temple. So as they come down from Mount Scopus, they see the Temple Mount. And what do you do when you see it for the first time in 30 days? In its destruction, you rend your garments, like you do when you lose someone close to you in love. You do what's called kriya. So they tore their garments out of the horror of seeing the destruction of the temple, the second temple. Then the four of them come down, and they're close to the Temple Mount. They have to be careful. There are certain areas you can't actually enter, but they're close by. And they see movement from within the confines of this overgrown Temple Mount area. And to their horror, they see a shual, a fox, emerge from the direct area that they calculate was the site of the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the holiest place in this world. The place literally where that Abraham and Isaac were during the Akedah, the mining of Isaac. Right? It took place right at that place. So from the Holy of Holies, and Rabbi Akiva and these rabbis are old enough that they remember the temple when it was a temple. They were there during its destruction at the hands of the Romans. So it's very real. They knew exactly precise locations of what they were seeing. So a fox emerges from the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And it is devastating. That was the one place that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would go in. Achas Bashana. One time a year, the Jewish Kohen, the high priest, would enter on Yom HaKippurim, the holiest day of the year, on the Day of Atonement. And he would seek atonement out for all of the Jewish people. And I don't have to tell you how dangerous it is for anyone to go in there. I mean, you all saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Ark was stored within the confines of that Holy of Holies for many, many years. Not at the end, but earlier. Okay. So what happens? The three rabbis with Rabbi Akiva, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Yeshua, they are blown away. And they just openly weep. They shake, and tears come down. A at the sight of an animal, a fox, in the holiest place in the world. They're devastated. It's emotional. And Rabbi Akiva starts to laugh out loud. Laughter. Laughter. Now you might say, but Rabbi, sometimes laughter with tears of joy, tears of hurt. Yeah, I know that there's a very close relationship between sometimes you laugh so hard that you cry, right? But that's not what's going on here. This is not laughter out of tears of horror, tears of shock, tears of dismay. Rabbi Akiva is genuinely laughing with joy, with simcha. And it doesn't make any sense. So the three rabbis are drying their eyes and looking at Rabbi Akiva, who's just laughing. And they say, why are you laughing, Akiva? And Rabbi Akiva says, well, why are you crying? Why are we crying? I think it's a kind of a self-evident truth. It says in the Torah, "Bahazar ha-karev yumas," that a regular person who goes into this area is instantly, lasered out of this world, is killed instantly by God. And a dirty animal is in this area where the holiest place in the world. Obviously, that's why we have a response of tears. What else would you expect? Why are you laughing? So this is where it gets incredible. So now you have to know a little backstory, okay? So there was a prophet named Yeshayahu, Isaiah. And Isaiah, this magnificent Navi prophet, he links up two other prophecies. And he essentially says, Isaiah, that these two prophecies, one by a Kohen, by a priest named Uriah, who lived in the time of Temple 1, and Zechariah, I love all these names in English. They all sound, I always say them in English, and they sound, wow, they're cool names. So you have Isaiah linking the prophecies of Uriah and Zechariah. And the prophecies relate to the Jewish people, the past, present, and the future. And the words of Isaiah are the following, that God says that these two witnesses, Uriah, whatever he says, well, we'll talk about it in a moment, and Zechariah, whatever he says, they are linked, and one is dependent upon the other. Not only will they come true, but they can't come true unless both come true. Wow. So what are these magnificent prophecies? So Uriah, who is unfortunately murdered by a king named Hilkiyahu, that's another story, Uriah had a prophecy, and it was a very, very tragic prophecy. Okay, you don't need to look inside, but I'll read it to you. Uriah says like this. Uriah says that in the future, Lachen biglachem tzion sadeh techaresh. Because of this, because of you guys, you Jewish people, Zion, Jerusalem, Israel, will be plowed over, plowed asunder like a field, like a forest. Meaning, Zion, Jerusalem, the temple, gone because of your sins, because of your aveirot, because of your crimes. This was the prophecy of Uriah. He lived again in the time of the first temple, Solomon's magnificent temple, which had not yet been destroyed when he made this Nevius, this prophecy. So he's predicting, because of your sins, your Averos, you're going to lose this magnificent temple, and it will be turned into a wasteland. It'll just become like a forest, overwrought, and overrun. Okay. Then, Zechariah, again, Isaiah links these two, has another prophecy. And this prophecy is a great prophecy. And he says the following. He says that in the future, this is Zechariah, there will come a time, odd, still there will come a future time, yeshvu zekenim uzekenos, where old men and old women will sit and sip coffee and drink tea, birachavos Yerushalayim, in the streets of Jerusalem. And it goes on to say, and the little children, their voices and merriment will be heard as they joyfully play in the streets of Jerusalem again. So that's Zechariah. So Isaiah is saying the two are linked. So Rabbi Akiva turns to these other three rabbis. He says, This is why I'm laughing with joy. Because Uriah, when did he live? He lived in the time of Temple number one, before Temple one was destroyed. Therefore, I always worried that when he predicts the destruction of the temple, it was limited to which temple? Only the first. And therefore, the prophecy of Zechariah, when he comes along and says Jerusalem will yet be rebuilt, the old and the young will all enjoy, I thought that was the second temple being rebuilt after the story of Purim, the one we just lost that we're looking at right now with the fox. But now that I see the fox coming out with my own eyes, and the prophecy of Uriah clearly was not limited just to the first temple, but it also goes on the second temple. It means that the prophecy of Zechariah that the old and young will play in Jerusalem is still a future event that hasn't happened. That God has promised there will be a third temple that will be rebuilt, and the Jewish people will return to Israel, rebuild that third Beit HaMikdash, and there will be ultimate redemption for our world. And that is why I'm laughing. Because until this moment that I saw the fox emerge, I always was worried which Uriah prophecy. Was it on one or two temples? Now I know it must be on both of them and their destruction, which means what is unfulfilled? Zechariah's prophecy, it is yet to be fulfilled. But since God testified that I promise you, God said, one will come true and then the other. Now that I see the fulfillment of Uriah's prophecy of destruction, then I know with certainty that Zechariah's prophecy of the return to Zion, it will happen. And that's why I'm laughing. And the rabbis looked at Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, and they wiped away their tears, and they said the following words, Akiva, nichamtanu, Akiva, nichamtanu. Rabbi Akiva, you have comforted us. Rabbi Akiva, you have comforted us. And so while we are in darkness now, there's no question that we look at our world, we look at Israel, we look at America, and we fear for the future, we see darkness. We need to grab a hold of the coattails of the great Rabbi Akiva. And we need to keep the hope, because whatever the losses are, Rabbi Akiva also faced tremendous hardship and loss. And yet he was able to laugh. And he's able to touch on this absolute havtocha, this promise that God made, that one day there will be a third temple, and there will be peace, and there will be a redemption. And the old and the young will rejoice along the streets of Jerusalem once again. We should merit this should happen soon in our times. B'mehirah v'amenah.